Hello, this is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader, Joanne Lowney, with the Wall Street Journal Business News for Wednesday, January 14th, 2026. And here are today's business headlines. Tesla's full self-driving system will only be available via subscription, Musk says. The electric vehicle maker currently offers the advanced driver assistance features for a one-time payment of $8,000 or a subscription of $99 a month in the U.S. by Maru Oru. Czechoslovak group aims to raise $873 million in Amsterdam IPO. The defense company, a key supplier of ammunition, plans to list on Euronext Amsterdam in coming weeks by Adria Cataliad. Saks Global files for bankruptcy, undone by debt and a luxury slump. The owner of Saks, Neiman Marcus and Bergdorf Goodman, becomes the highest profile department store chain to file for Chapter 11 since the pandemic by Suzanne Kapner and Becky Yarek. Netflix preparing to make Warner bid all cash. The companies had struck a $72 billion cash and stock deal in December by Joe Flint and Jessica Tunkel. Former Neiman Sachs chief is picked to lead Sachs through bankruptcy. Jeffrey Van Riemsdonk steered Neiman Marcus through its own Chapter 11 proceedings before selling the luxury retailer to Sachs in 2024 by Suzanne Kapner and Alexander Gladstone. AI startup sued by Palantir says company wants to scare others from leaving. Percepta, founded by two ex-Palantir employees, says Palantir's lawsuit hinges on an overly broad interpretation of employment agreements by Angel Aoyoung. Our first article today is Tesla's full self-driving system will only be available via subscription, Musk says, by Maru Oru. Tesla, Chief Executive Elon Musk said the electronic vehicle maker would stop selling a suite of advanced driver assistance features for a one-time payment, switching instead to a monthly subscription service. The company's full-service driving system makes it easier for drivers to change lanes and navigate around other vehicles and objects, but doesn't make vehicles fully autonomous and is meant to be used only with a fully attentive driver. Tesla currently offers the FSD system for a one-time payment of $8,000 or a subscription of $99 a month in the U.S., according to Tesla's website. Musk wrote in a post on X that Tesla would stop selling the system after February 14th, making it only available through a monthly subscription. He didn't elaborate on the decision to remove the one-time payment option. Tesla shares slipped 0.6% pre-market. Tesla's FSD system carries more features than its autopilot package, which the company describes as a standard advanced driver assistant system that is meant to enhance safety and convenience. Autopilot comes with traffic-aware cruise control and auto-steer features, which are also included in Tesla's FSD system on top of auto lane change, auto park, and other features, according to Tesla's website. Musk's announcement comes after Tesla, once the top seller of electric vehicles, lost its crown to China's BYD. Tesla sales fell 9% in 2025 and 16% for the fourth quarter compared with a year prior. Write to Maru Oru at maru.oru at wsj.com. Defense company Czechoslovak Group aims to raise $873 million in Amsterdam IPO. European defense company Czechoslovak Group said it plans to list on Euronext Amsterdam in coming weeks and that it aims to raise 750 million euros or $873.3 million as part of its initial public offering. The Prague-based company, a key supplier of ammunition, is the latest arms maker to try to tap into a rally in European defense stocks amid a spending boom as the continent pushes to rearm. German industrial conglomerate ThyssenKrupp in October spun off its naval defense business TKMS and Franco-German defense group KNDS in December said it would list in Paris and the Frankfurt in 2026. Czechoslovak Group, or CSG, said it is seeking to raise 750 million euros through the issue of new shares. The offering will also include existing shares, but the amount has yet to be determined, the company said. The company said it received commitments to invest in its IPO from Artisan Partners, BlackRock Funds, and Qatar Investment Authority, subsidiary of Al Rayan Holding, that amount to 900 million euros in total. The IPO is expected to take place in the coming weeks, subject to market conditions, CSG said. We believe an IPO of CSG would elevate the profile of the group within the international investment community, providing additional financial flexibility and diversity of funding sources to support further growth, Chairman Michael Strand said. Write to Adria Catalayud at adria.catalayud@wsj.com. Saks Global files for bankruptcy, undone by debt and a luxury slump, by Suzanne Kapner and Becky Yerick. The parent of Saks Fifth Avenue and Neiman Marcus filed for bankruptcy protection, barely a year after an ambitious bet on luxury department stores brought the two storied retailers together in what was supposed to be a powerhouse deal. The swift unraveling of Saks Global shows the perils of doubling down on department stores whose golden days are long past. The plan behind the $2.7 billion merger was to create a luxury juggernaut, while cost savings from the deal were expected to help Saks dig out of a deepening hole of delayed payments to suppliers. But with a roughly $100 million debt payment looming in December and sales declining, the company ran out of time. It is now the highest-profile department store chain to file for Chapter 11 since the pandemic. Jeffrey Van Romandonk, the former chief executive of Neiman Marcus, has now been picked to lead Saks through bankruptcy as its CEO, effective immediately. In all, Saks has secured roughly $1.75 billion in financing for the process, the company said early Wednesday. Things went wrong for Saks even before its merger with Neiman Marcus. A widespread slowdown in luxury goods that began in 2023 hurt sales. Saks struggled to pay vendors, some of which curtailed shipments or stopped shipping goods. That made it harder for Saks to bring in revenue. Saks further angered suppliers last February when it extended payment terms to 90 days from the typical 60 days. Back payments would be spread among 12 monthly installments beginning in July rather than made in a lump sum, according to memo sent to suppliers on Valentine's Day. The company raised an additional $600 million in June through a debt restructuring, but sales continued to fall, dropping 13% from a year earlier to $1.6 billion for the period ending August 2nd. The net loss widened to $288 million. Days after missing the $100 million debt payment, longtime CEO Mark Metrick resigned. Executive Chairman Richard Baker briefly took over before stepping down as well on Tuesday. A bondholder group, including Pentwater Capital and Bracebridge Capital, has now agreed to provide $1 billion of debtor-in-possession financing to carry Saks through bankruptcy. Saks said early Wednesday, asset-based lenders led by Bank of America will release about $250 million in credit. In addition, the bondholder group agreed to fund an additional $500 million of equity financing upon emergence of bankruptcy. The company's implosion has left the fashion industry reeling, with suppliers wondering if they will be made whole and shoppers lamenting the weakened state of yet more iconic retailers following the bankruptcies in recent years of Barneys, New York, Lord & Taylor, and Hudson's Bay in Canada. The latter two had been owned by Baker. Assuming Saks Global is able to reorganize and emerge from bankruptcy, it will likely be a smaller entity with fewer stores. There are roughly 33 Saks stores in 36 Neiman Marcus locations, a handful of which are in the same mall or city. The company also includes two Bergdorf Goodman stores and about 70 Saks Off Fifth discount stores. As part of the bankruptcy process, Saks said, it is evaluating its operational footprint to invest resources where it has the greatest long-term potential. Department stores used to have clout over their suppliers, but in recent years, some suppliers such as Louis Vuitton, parent LVMH, and Gucci, parent Kering, have grown so big that they tower over the retailers they sell to. More important, brands of all sizes have opened their own boutiques, competing directly with their department store customers. Although Saks is inextricably linked to New York through its flagship store across the street from Rockefeller Center, it got its start in Washington, D.C. in 1867, when Andrew and Isidore Saks opened a men's clothing store. In 1902, the brothers opened a large store in New York City's Herald Square near Macy's that sold men's and women's fashions. When Andrew died in 1912, his son Horace Saks took over. Two decades later, Saks & Company merged with another department store company, Gimbel Brothers, which was owned by Horace's cousin, Bernard Gimbel. Saks continued to operate as an autonomous subsidiary and in 1924 opened its now famed location at 611 Fifth Avenue, across the street from what would become Rockefeller Center. The move was controversial. Saks was among the first large retailers to locate in what was then primarily a residential area, not far from the Vanderbilt and Astor mansions. The building, with its limestone facade, took up an entire city block. In the ensuing years, Saks opened stores throughout the country and cycled from one owner to another. In 1973, it was bought by cigarette maker British American Tobacco. Next came Investcorp, the Bahrain investment firm, which acquired the retailer in 1990. Saks went public in 1996 and 2 years later merged with middle market department store company Profits, which changed its name to Saks. In 2013, it was bought by HBC, a holding company of which Baker was executive chairman. At the time, it included Lord & Taylor and the Hudson's Bay department store chain in Canada. When HBC bought Saks department stores and had been failing for decades, Gimbel's went out of business in the 1990s. Lord & Taylor filed for bankruptcy in 2020 and closed all its stores, though it continues to operate online. Neiman Marcus filed for bankruptcy in 2020, but emerged later that year. And Hudson's Bay closed all its stores in 2025, after filing for bankruptcy protection. Part of the appeal of Saks was its real estate. Less than a year after HBC agreed to buy Saks, the chain's Fifth Avenue location was valued at $3.7 billion, more than the $2.9 billion price of the entire deal. Unlike some investors who buy retailers and strip them for the real estate, HBC poured money into Saks, completing a $300 million renovation of the Fifth Avenue store around 2019 that included a Rem Koolhaas-designed escalator. As part of the reboot, it moved cosmetics and fragrances from the ground floor, where they had resided since the store opened, to the second floor. Handbags and leather goods took over the store's most valuable ground for real estate. The move was considered a gamble at the time by some industry executives because cosmetics and fragrances had long been a good source of impulse purchase and a way to pull shoppers into the store. In 2021, Saks undertook another controversial move. It split its stores and e-commerce businesses into separate companies. The move was designed to pave the way for a digital business to sell shares to the public. But once the shares of other digital pure players, such as Farfetch, collapsed, a listing was no longer viable. Department stores are known for their lavish holiday window displays. But in 2023, Saks upped the ante when it partnered with French luxury brand Dior. The facade of the 10-story building was transformed into a carousel that turned into a light show every evening. Each of the windows displayed scenes of New York and Paris. Saks canceled its holiday light show in 2024, but reinstated it in 2025. In recent months, Saks Global tried to cut deals to raise cash. In December, it sold the land beneath the Neiman Marcus stores in Beverly Hills and San Francisco for about $100 million, according to a person familiar with the deals. And it had been trying to sell 49% of Bergdorf Goodman for about $1 billion, according to people familiar with the situation. With the debt payment looming, time ran out. Write to Suzanne Kapner at suzanne.kapner@wsj.com and Becky Yarek at becky.yerak@wsj.com. Netflix preparing to make Warner bid all cash. Companies had struck a $72 billion cash and stock deal in December by Joe Flint and Jessica Tunkel. Netflix is preparing to make its bid for Warner Brothers Discovery's studios and HBO Max streaming business all cash, according to people familiar with the matter, as Paramount Skydance continues pushing its competing offer. Netflix struck a $72 billion cash and stock deal with Warner in December. Making it all cash would simplify Netflix's deal and could sway some shareholders who have been weighing the two offers. Paramount made a hostile all-cash $77.9 billion bid for Warner. It has accused the company of not meaningfully engaging with it. On Monday, Paramount increased the pressure on Warner by unveiling plans to launch a proxy fight for Warner board seats and filing a lawsuit for more information about the deal with Netflix. Warner has said its board unanimously concluded Paramount's offer isn't superior to its existing deal with Netflix. Bloomberg earlier reported on Netflix's plans to alter its bid. Write to Joe Flint at joe.flint@wsj.com and Jessica Tunkel at jessica.tunkel@wsj.com. European defense companies in line to benefit from bulk of EU's $105 billion Ukraine loan. The loan proposal is still to be approved by the European Parliament and representatives of EU countries, by Christina Gallardo. The European Union said Ukraine must buy weapons and military platforms from European manufacturers under a new 90 billion euro $104.8 billion loan, unless they aren't able to supply what Kyiv needs. The European Commission on Wednesday outlined its proposal for the loan, intended to cover Ukraine's financial needs for this year and next. Ursula von der Leyen, president of the EU's executive arm, told a press conference that 60 billion euros would be set aside for military requirements, with the remainder earmarked to cover Ukraine's basic services. The Commission is aiming to make the first payment to Kyiv by April. With this support, we're making sure that Ukraine can, on one hand, bolster its defense in the battlefield and strengthen its defense capabilities so that all the military needs, and on the other hand, keep the state and the basic services running, von der Leyen said. The loan program will prioritize purchases of military equipment made by companies based in the EU or associated countries such as Norway and Switzerland, as well as in Ukraine itself. But the document leaves the door open to purchase from outside Europe if necessary, as long as Kyiv obtains the approval of the Commission. Taking into account the fact that Ukraine is a country at war, whose capacity to defend its territory might depend on the availability of a given product at very short term, Ukraine should be allowed to procure products which do not comply with these eligibility conditions, where there is an urgent need for a product, and where no alternative product is available by procurement, the Commission proposal states. The loan proposal is said to be approved by the European Parliament and representatives of EU countries. Write to Christina Gallardo at christina.gallardo@wsj.com. China's trade surplus reaches record, defying expectations of tariff-driven slowdown. China reported $1.19 trillion surplus in 2025, with exports growing 5.5%, by Hannah Miao. When President Trump returned to the White House last year, economists predicted new tariffs would stifle China's massive export machine. Instead, China's trade surplus, the difference between its exports and imports, reached a record in 2025 at $1.19 trillion. Exports jumped 5.5% last year from 2024 in dollar-denominated terms, compared with 5.9% growth the prior year, China's customs agency reported on Wednesday. Shipments to the U.S. fell, but Chinese manufacturers found new customers in the rest of the world. The global economy, powered by AI spending, kept chugging along, keeping external demand strong, and another year of producer price deflation made Chinese goods attractive to overseas buyers. The result, strong exports, helped power China's economy to expectation-defying growth last year, even as the property market and consumer sentiment in the country remained in the doldrums. Exports to the U.S. dropped 20% in 2025. Meanwhile, exports to a bloc of Southeast Asian countries jumped 13%. Those in the European Union rose 8.4%, those to Latin America increased 7.4%, and those to Africa surged 26%. Overall exports for the month of December grew 6.6% year over year, up from 5.9% in November, while imports rose 5.7%. As some U.S. buyers have adjusted sourcing to sidestep higher tariffs on made in China goods, supply chains that have shifted from China to places such as Vietnam or Mexico often still rely on Chinese components or equipment, keeping the country's formidable manufacturing ecosystem busy. China's global trade imbalance has increasingly become a geopolitical liability. Some places, such as the European Union, worry that a flood of cheap Chinese goods could hurt local industries. The International Monetary Fund has warned that China, The world's second largest economy is too big to rely on exports for growth. At the beginning of the year, some wondered if Trump's tariffs might push Chinese leaders to restructure the economy to lean more on consumer spending rather than exports, something long called for by many Western economists and some Chinese policy advisors. But the surprising resilience of Chinese exports took off some of the short-term pressure for Beijing to increase consumption. A program offering subsidies to buy household appliances and electric vehicles helped perk up spending earlier last year, but retail sales momentum has since waned. Analysts have described China's economy as K-shaped or two-track. Exports and manufacturing are driving economic growth, while the real estate sector and household demands are lagging. Some economists believe it could be difficult for China to reprise such strong export growth in 2026. The chaotic on-again, off-again U.S. tariffs last year sparked front-loading of orders that accounted for some of China's export rush. Still, many analysts don't expect China's export prowess to weaken anytime soon. Global demand should remain resilient, and Chinese manufacturers have proved their competitiveness despite tariffs. A trade truce between the U.S. and China has created tentative stability in tariff policy. Beijing recently announced that it would phase out export tax rebates for solar products and batteries, which have experienced significant price declines because of oversupply. Write to Hannah Miao at hannah.miao@wsj.com. Global economy records stronger growth, but is on course for a weak decade, says the World Bank. Much of the improvement was due to a stronger U.S. performance, by Paul Hannon. The global economy is set to grow more rapidly than previously expected in the face of President Trump's tariff hikes, thanks in part to a U.S. boom in AI investment, but is nonetheless on course for its weakest decade in half a century, the World Bank said on Tuesday. In a twice-yearly report on the economic outlook, the Washington, D.C.-based investment bank's economists reversed many of the cuts to forecasts they announced in June as the higher duties were being rolled out. In common with other forecasters, they have been surprised by the global economy's ability to adjust to the largest rise in tariffs in a century. In the face of one shock after another, the global economy has proved to be surprisingly shockproof since the pandemic, said Indermitt Gill, the World Bank's chief economist. The bank's economists estimate that the U.S. economy grew by 2.1% last year, a much better performance than the 1.4% growth they expected to see in June, but still a slowdown from 2024. They lifted their forecast for growth this year to 2.2% from 1.6%. Sharply higher investment in AI-related equipment and structures helped support growth, the World Bank said. The bank's economists also upgraded their assessment of the global economy and now estimate it grew by 2.7% in 2025, a stronger outcome than the 2.3% expansion forecast in June and only slightly weaker than 2024. Growth is expected to slow to 2.6% this year, a stronger outcome than the previous forecast of 2.4%. Growth could turn out to be weaker than expected this year if there is a fresh round of tariff hikes, a sharp fall in equity prices, or a jump in government bond yields fueled by investor concerns about rising debts. But the World Bank said growth could also be stronger if the boom in AI investment spreads. Boosted by U.S. imports of AI-related equipment, front-loading ahead of the imposition of tariffs, and the modest scale of retaliation, global trade flows are estimated to have grown more rapidly than foreseen, increasing at a 3.4% clip that has unchanged from 2024. However, trade flows are expected to slow sharply this year as higher tariffs take a greater toll. While much of the improvement in global growth is the result of a stronger U.S. performance, other large economies have also proved more resilient than anticipated. The World Bank raised its estimate for Chinese economic growth in 2025 to 4.9% from 4.5%, and its forecast for this year to 4.4% from 4%. The economists estimate that Eurozone economy grew by 1.4% last year, having forecast an expansion of 0.7% in June. India also grew much faster than expected last year, with the World Bank now estimating that its gross domestic product increased by 7.2%, having forecast an expansion of 6.3%. But while the global economy has adjusted to a series of shocks that include the COVID-19 pandemic and the fallout from Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, more successfully than anticipated, those big shocks keep on coming. The result is that the global economy is now on course for its weakest decade of growth since the 1960s, according to World Bank, which expects global output to expand by 2.7% in 2027. With each passing year, the global economy has become less capable of generating growth and seemingly more resilient to policy uncertainty, said Gill. The sluggish pace of global growth will make it more challenging for developing economies to close the income gap with their advanced counterparts, the World Bank said. By the end of last year, per capita incomes in almost all advanced economies exceeded the levels recorded in 2019. However, the World Bank estimates that incomes in one out of four developing countries had yet to recover to their pre-pandemic levels. And while many advanced economies are already seeing a decline in the number of workers due to aging, many developing economies still need to find ways to productively employ a swelling working age population. These trends could intensify the job creation challenge confronting developing economies, where 1.2 billion young people will reach working age over the next decade, the World Bank said. Write to Paul Hannon at paul.hannon@wsj.com. This is your volunteer broadcaster, Joanne Lowney. If you miss any part of this program, you can get it on demand on our website, sunsounds.org, then click on our broadcast info and audio. You can take SunSounds with you, get our stream and on demand on our new SunSounds of Arizona app for Apple and Android phones. And you can hear Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or smart home device. Now back to our next article. U.S. blows up China's Latin America ambitions with Maduro ouster. Beijing recalculating its policy of making inroads in Washington's backyard after its top ally there was deposed, by Wingling Wei. The U.S. ouster of the Venezuelan strongman Nicolas Maduro is forcing Beijing into a high-stakes recalculation of its ambitions in a region that looks like America's backyard again, said people close to internal discussions in the Chinese leadership. For years, China made inroads into Latin America, coaxing countries to abandon support for Taiwan with loans to build roads, ports, and rail lines, making significant purchases of commodities like soybeans and oil, and mining metals such as copper. Maduro was its most important ally and an anti-American leader with oil resources, earning Venezuela the rare distinction of an all-weather partnership, China's highest diplomatic honor, with a status held by no other country in Latin America. Now Beijing is no longer seeking to make new advances into the region in the near term, the people said. Instead, the discourse in China's policy-making circles has shifted toward a potential trade-off. If the Western Hemisphere belongs to the Americans, then the Taiwan Strait belongs to the Chinese. This calculation doesn't mean China considers the U.S. action in Venezuela a green light for an immediate action to take back Taiwan, a democratically ruled island that Beijing views as a breakaway province. Rather, U.S. action against Maduro by force bolsters China as it gives priority to its core interests, chiefly bringing Taiwan under its control. China's leaders had already been watching its influence in Latin America wane since President Trump returned to the White House a year ago. Mexico recently imposed 50% tariffs on Chinese electric vehicles to align with Washington ahead of the high-stakes 2026 review of the North American Free Trade Pact. Panama has moved back into the U.S. orbit, withdrawing from Chinese leader Xi Jinping's signature Belt and Road Initiative, while allowing rotating stays for U.S. military personnel at bases near the canal. Even Honduras, which broke ties with Taiwan in 2023, is wobbling. The country's shrimp industry has largely collapsed after failing to find the promised high-value markets in China, leading to significant domestic economic strain. Now President-elect Nasri Asfura, who was endorsed by Trump, appears poised to fulfill a campaign promise of switching back to recognizing Taipei. By December, as losses mounted in the region, Beijing issued a policy paper on Latin America's suggesting it wouldn't give up its ambitions there, a stance it can later use to extract concessions from Washington over Taiwan. Then, just after New Year's Day, Xi dispatched a special envoy to Venezuela with a mission to stop the bleeding. According to the people familiar with the internal discussions, the goal for the envoy, Kui Zaiqi, was to secure what Beijing calls Jibenpan, the strategic foundation of China's Latin America influence. This meant ensuring repayment of more than $10 billion in outstanding debt owed by Venezuela and continued access to the world's largest crude reserves. Hours after Kui met Maduro on January 3rd, U.S. Special Operations Forces swooped into Venezuela's capital, Caracas, and after an intense firefight, left with the country's leader. With that, China's decade-long project to secure a geostrategic foothold in America's backyard was suddenly upended. Now, China has a stack of toxic IOUs from Venezuela and is dealing with a regime that must put a priority on Trump, who has called himself the country's acting president. Maduro's successor, Delcy Rodriguez, has met with Chinese Ambassador Lan Hu to offer reassurances to Beijing's interests in the country. No matter how the political situation in Venezuela evolves, China's willingness to deepen practical cooperation with Venezuela in various fields will not change, Liu Pengyu, a spokesman for the Chinese embassy in Washington, D.C., said in response to questions from the Wall Street Journal. But the U.S. is already moving to reshape who controls Venezuela's oil fields, where China has major interests. Policy analysts close to the White House said the U.S. could replace Chinese infrastructure in Venezuela with American-led ventures. Essentially, the analysts said the Trump administration could offer the new Venezuela government an opportunity for the U.S. to facilitate the restructuring of the country's debt in exchange for exclusive rights for American companies to develop and extract its oil. This move would effectively sideline China. White House spokeswoman Anna Kelly said restoring American preeminence in the Western Hemisphere involves enlisting established friends to help bolster mutual security in the region and cultivating new partners in the region. Beijing's goal is now defensive, said the people close to internal discussions, ensuring it isn't erased from the ledger of Venezuela's oil reserves entirely. This strategic retreat, these people said, might well be what China expects from the U.S. in the Taiwan Strait. Other enticements Chinese officials are considering, they said, involve Beijing's potentially agreeing to purchase billions of dollars of long-term treasuries. The expected April summit between Xi and Trump in Beijing will likely offer the first real test of China's new calculus. The Chinese leadership is hoping to gauge whether Trump's America First focus on the Western Hemisphere, the people said, is an opening for China to exert more control over its own periphery, or if the Venezuelan operation was merely the first chapter in a global reassertion of American power. In Beijing, some hardliners see Trump's focus on the Western Hemisphere as a distraction that could leave a vacuum in the Asia-Pacific. The administration calls the policy the Trump corollary to the Monroe Doctrine, a 19th century warning to Europe from President James Monroe against new colonization in the Western Hemisphere, which he claimed as the U.S.'s exclusive domain. Others argue that Trump's authorization of the Maduro ouster proves that American interventionism is far from the paper tiger that Beijing hawks had hoped. The fall of Maduro has forced Beijing into a new respect for the Monroe Doctrine, said Yun Sun, director of the China program at the Stimson Center. Trump's willingness to use hard power proves that American resolve is a reality that Beijing must also take seriously. While Trump himself has remained noncommittal regarding a military defense of Taiwan, his administration's 2025 national security strategy provides a clearer road map for U.S. interests. The document, released late last year, frames the island as an indispensable gear in the global economy. The strategy explicitly gives priority to preserving military overmatch to deter conflict, viewing Taiwan as a vital maritime gatekeeper in the first island chain that protects American trade from Chinese dominance. Beijing's new calculus will face its first major test later this month. Taiwan's President Lei Ching-te has indicated a desire to attend ASFURA's inauguration in Honduras on January 27th, said people familiar with the matter. A spokesman at Taiwan's Ministry of Foreign Affairs said in December that Taipei remained open to engaging with all nations, including Honduras, without preconditions. Beijing is closely watching whether the Trump administration will grant Lei a transit through the U.S. en route to Central America, a privilege denied to him last year. One particular sting to Beijing came from Moscow. While a Chinese envoy was still drafting statements on Beijing's all-weather partnership with Venezuela, Russia had already begun a quiet evacuation of its diplomats' families in late December. The people close to Beijing said that Moscow, which publicly denied a news report on the evacuation, didn't inform the Chinese of its plan. Write to Ling Wei at linglingwei@wsj.com. Wall Street is suddenly on the defensive with the president. Trump's affordability push ahead of the midterms has turned some of the financial sector's darlings into punching bags, by Gregory Zuckerman. Wall Street thought it had an ally in Donald Trump. He's becoming more of an adversary. The president largely delivered to investors last year as his administration cut taxes, reduced spending, and rolled back an aggressive tariff plan after it spooked markets. Now, after blindsiding Wall Street with a series of rapid-fire moves in the span of a week, Trump appears to be putting it on notice. He sought to block large investors from buying houses, called for a cap on credit card rates, and announced restrictions on executive pay and stock buybacks. Then came the most stunning move of all, the Justice Department's criminal investigation of Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell in what he said was an intimidation tactic to lower interest rates. Investors thought after the April 2025 tariffs that uncertainty around policy would magically go away, says Brad Golding, a hedge fund manager at Christofferson, Robb & Company in New York. Now we're seeing that midterm elections mean more than the profitability of banks and the stability of markets. News of the investigation, which prompted J.P. Morgan Chase Chief Executive Jamie Dimon and others in the banking world to defend the Fed, was an escalation in Trump's pressure campaign on the Fed to lower rates. It was a clear message that voters' concerns about the cost of living and not investors are now top of mind. On Monday evening, Trump issued his latest broadside against business on social media, saying he was working with Microsoft and other tech giants to make sure consumers don't pick up the tab for higher electricity prices as heavy investment in artificial intelligence fuels power demand from data centers. White House spokesman Kush Desai said in a statement that multiple record stock market highs and rising real wages show Trump can unleash historic prosperity for consumers and investors alike. Investors can't say they weren't warned. Administration officials have spent over a year saying they were going to try to help consumers and others, even at the expense of investors. For the last four decades, Wall Street has grown wealthier than ever before. For the next 4 years, it's Main Street's turn, Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent told a group of bankers last April. Investors are bracing for the next surprise from Trump that could drive stock moves. The administration has indicated more affordability proposals could be unveiled when he appears at the World Economic Forum next week. Expect the unexpected and position portfolios accordingly, said Dan Ivesen, Chief Investment Officer at PIMCO, the bond powerhouse. PIMCO has made changes to its portfolio, including buying more debt from non-U.S. issuers. Already, Trump's call Friday evening for a temporary 10% cap on credit card interest rates helped send shares of big card issuers and network providers lower on Monday and Tuesday. Shares in Citigroup, American Express, Capital One, MasterCard, and Visa all dropped between 4% and just over 7% in the span of those 2 days. His plan, announced last week, to block big investors from buying up single-family homes, dented shares of two big single-family landlords, and Blackstone, which owns a smaller rival. The shares have recovered some since. Stock indexes, more broadly, aren't reflecting too much concern, partly because investors have grown accustomed to Trump backing away from many ideas. Some proposals would require congressional backing, which might not materialize. House Speaker Mike Johnson signaled Tuesday that Trump's credit card rate proposal would face a steep climb in Congress. The credit card proposal will probably not happen, and the same with the restrictions on institutional home buying, said Peter Bukavar, Chief Investment Officer at One Point BFG Wealth Partners. So markets are in a wait-and-see mode. The investigation into Powell drew immediate criticism from former Fed and Treasury officials and lawmakers, including from Senator Tom Tillis, a member of the Senate Banking Committee, and others who could hinder Trump's ability to get a replacement for Powell confirmed. J.P. Morgan's Dimon and Bank of New York Mellon CEO Robin Vince both defended the Federal Reserve on calls Tuesday, discussing their bank's quarterly results. Dimon said political interference with the Fed would cause inflation and interest rates to go up rather than accomplish Trump's stated goal of lowering them. The probe of Powell may even encourage him to stay on as Fed board member after his term as chairman expires later this year, or bolster efforts to ensure that the next chairman has the independence to pursue policy. Other proposals could also have unintended consequences, which could explain the market's subdued response. Cutting interest rates on credit cards, for example, could limit access to credit for lower and middle income consumers, trade groups have warned. Stopping institutional investors from buying homes to rent sounds good, too, but it could negatively hurt those families who want to live in a house but can't afford to buy, said Bukvar. Also, it could dissuade home builders from adding new home supply to the market. Trump's affordability push could hit other industries, not just the financial sector. The administration has suggested that it hopes to lower gasoline prices for U.S. consumers, potentially by adding Venezuelan oil to the market. Lower prices at the pump would help drivers, but potentially weigh on the profits of energy companies. Still, Wall Street analysts often look for reasons for optimism, even when news is unsettling. On Monday, Morgan Stanley told clients the Trump administration's efforts to give priority to housing affordability would help some consumer-related stocks. And if the administration offers incentives to home builders, encouraging them to boost housing supply, that could boost earnings of those companies. Write to Gregory Zuckerman at gregory.zuckerman@wsj.com. The affordability problem in one chart. Wages aren't rising fast enough to counter still rising prices. By the editorial board. President Trump keeps telling Americans they've never had it better, even as polls show Americans are still worried about keeping up with rising prices. Tuesday's two reports from the Labor Department on prices and wages helped to explain Mr. Trump's political problem. They show the two sides of the affordability coin. Regarding prices, the Consumer Price Index came in somewhat better than expected, with an increase of 0.3% in December and 2.7% over the past 12 months. Overall inflation isn't rising, but it also isn't coming down. Increases last month were especially notable for categories of goods and services that Americans buy on a regular basis, like shelter, 0.4%, medical care, 0.4%, food, 0.7%, and energy bills, 1%. Housing costs have eased in recent months, but electricity and gas bills are still up 7.7% over the year, and tenant and household insurance climbed 8.2%. Lower and middle-income Americans spend a larger share of their paychecks on energy, food, and housing, so they are no doubt feeling this inflation more acutely than the affluent. Economists differ on the price impact of the Trump tariffs, though they seem to have contributed to rising prices last year on some goods such as furniture and bedding, 3.6%, and tools and hardware, 5.4%. The other side of affordability is what people earn. And on that score, a separate labor report Tuesday on real earnings is revealing. The nearby chart shows the trend in average hourly earnings after inflation in the last year. Real average hourly earnings rose 0.7% during the first 5 months of this year, but income growth has since stalled. For production and non-subsidiary workers, real average hourly earnings have declined 0.2% since May. The reason is a bump in inflation in the summer months that erased gains from wage increases. The earnings jump in March and May has given way to flat or negative growth. Monthly data for October and November aren't available because the government shut down, but average hourly earnings through December rose only 1.1% over the previous 12 months. This goes a long ways to explain why so many Americans feel as if they're treading financial water. It also shows that Mr. Trump ought to worry more about inflation than he does about the Federal Reserve's interest rate policy. The Fed still hasn't hit its 2% inflation target, and the way to get there isn't more monetary easing or cutting the Fed funds rate to 1%, as Mr. Trump wants. The president has recently been rolling out a flurry of counterproductive policies worthy of Bernie Sanders in the name of reducing prices. But what the president really needs is what he promised in the campaign, which is rising real wages. That means further reducing inflation and letting degradation and tax policy drive faster economic growth and productivity. That will make everything more affordable. DNC Chair Ken Martin on Iran and ICE. The head of the Democratic Party looks at Tehran regime and sees Trump's America by the editorial board. As President Trump cancels meetings with the Iranian regime, increases the economic pressure and promises imminent help for the protesters being slaughtered in the streets, the Democratic Party's boss has chimed in. Consider what Ken Martin, the Democratic National Committee chairman, has to say. From Tehran to my birthplace of Minneapolis, people are rising up against systems that wield violence without accountability, Mr. Martin wrote Sunday on social media. Solidarity across borders means opposing authoritarian power everywhere and defending the right to live free from fear of state violence. When told that the continuing massacres by Iran's regime and the tragic split-second January 7th killing of Rene Good by U.S. law enforcement officer aren't the same, Mr. Martin plunged deeper into moral equivalence. If comparing the U.S. to Iran makes you angry, ask why, he wrote. Killing protesters, crushing dissent, kidnapping and disappearing legal citizens, ignoring courts, threatening critics, terrorizing communities, that's authoritarian behavior anywhere. Overwrought rhetoric on domestic affairs is one thing. Yoking a false image of U.S. authoritarianism to the freedom struggle in Iran is obtuse. That's a slur against his own country. It also undermines the Iranian people, who count on the U.S. and call desperately for its help. To say America is yet another murderous tyranny, comparable to their own, Mr. Martin essentially told Iranians that the U.S. is on the side of their regime. The opposite is true. The mullahs fear the U.S., which stands athwart the global access of authoritarians and is looked to by freedom seekers in Tehran and freedom keepers in Taipei, Jerusalem, and even Kyiv. Unlike Mr. Martin, they know what authoritarianism is. Iranian officials leak that 2,000 or 3,000 people have been killed, but watchdogs say the real number is higher. London-based Iran International reports a regime intelligence finding of at least 12,000 dead. The regime has kept Iran offline since Thursday to cover up its murders. Mr. Trump is many things, but he isn't at all like Iran's rulers. As Iranian protesters well know, they call his name and rename streets for him in the hope the U.S. might help them. That's all the time we have for today's edition of the Wall Street Journal. I'm Joanne Lowney, your volunteer broadcaster on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Stay tuned for more interesting programs on Sun Sounds.